This webcast is a service of SDPB. Good, useful, and full of wonder. SDPB.
You may be seated. Thank you. The next appeal set for this morning is in the matter of Six Cataract Trusts. We have appeal number 31188, and then notice of review is 31202. Kimberly Dorsett is present, will be arguing on behalf of the appellee, Donald Netter, and Corey Donovan is present, will be arguing on behalf of the appellants, ANN and SN. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Dorsett, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Kimberly Dorsett, appearing and arguing on behalf of the appellee, Donald T. Netter. Also present at counsel table are Casey Marshall as co-counsel and our law office associate, Alex Stange-Weig. This court has directed briefing on a question that no South Dakota decision has squarely resolved up to this point, whether a notice of review filed after service of a notice of appeal under section 1526A22 remains available when the initial appeal is dismissed for a service defect. Our response is narrow. We take the position that a notice of review timely filed under section 1526A22 after service of a notice of appeal remains available for a decision before this court even after dismissal of the initiating appeal, provided that the appellee has satisfied the statute's stated requirements, which we did in this case. The second issue that I am prepared to argue today is equally narrow. We are asking the court to declare the trial court's Article I interpretation of the trust as non-binding dicta because the threshold procedural and statutory defenses would have resolved the Rule 60 relief that was being sought without that construction. So unless the court prefers otherwise, I will begin with the jurisdiction argument. As a threshold matter, the appellees do not dispute the governing rule for, I'm going to refer to the appellant or Ariana's appeal. If a required party was not timely served, South Dakota law treats that failure as jurisdictionally fatal to her appeal. It was not a technical error, and it was not waivable or curable. We concede that. But that question is not whether or not her appeal survives. We agree it does not. The question is whether her defect automatically voids our proper separate filing by a different party under a different statute with separate filing, docketing, and service requirements. We argue it does not. The appellee has independent appellant rights.
So if you're right, and I think we'll probably have to decide it, if you're right that the initial appeal was not properly perfected in that, in failure of service or whatever, but if you're right that we've failed to acquire appellate jurisdiction, did not acquire it at all because it was infirm, then your argument has to be that the first moment we acquired appellate jurisdiction was at your notice of review, with your notice of review filing, because there hadn't been any appellate jurisdiction up until that point, except perhaps the jurisdiction to entertain our jurisdiction, but the voluntary dismissal, or to consider our own jurisdiction, but the voluntary dismissal took care of that. So it seems like if we conclude there was never any jurisdiction, we have to accept as an underlying premise that your notice of review statute and procedure is itself a freestanding right to appeal.
A couple things I would point out on that. First of all, they are two independent statutes, and each statute independently establishes that party's separate right to review before the court.
They're actually court rules.
you only get review if there's a principal appeal. So there's that.
Right. And so from a timing perspective, we would point out that the notice of review was filed on September 4th, and until the court dismissed the notice of appeal on October 31st, technically the appeal was still pending. There hadn't been a ruling.
Pending, but jurisdiction is jurisdiction. And this runs throughout the law. It can never be waived, and you may operate for any period of time thinking a court has jurisdiction, but because it's so fundamental, we hold in all kinds of cases, it can't be waived. And so if the conclusion is there was no jurisdiction, regardless of whether it was pending or not pending or whatever, if there was no jurisdiction, how can we conclude that the notice of review statute represents its own right, freestanding right to appeal?
Well, the statute starts out that an appellee may obtain review, and then it proceeds to explain how we do that. Our right to that review is triggered by the appellant's notice of appeal being served upon my client. That's when the statutory timeline that he has to appeal starts. And so then the minute that that service is triggered and he has that 20-day notice, then he starts under his separate statute and establish his own jurisdiction to...
So the answer to my question is that the notice of review procedure is itself a separate, jurisdictionally independent basis for appellate review.
Yes, you said it better than I, but that's what I'm trying to argue.
Does the fact that you filed a motion to dismiss the appellant's appeal before filing the notice of review have any effect?
That's a good question. We would argue it does not, because again, it's a simple motion to dismiss that was filed in the notice of appeal file number, and then he had in the separate notice of review statute an obligation to pursue his own notice of review under that separate docket number.
I suppose an argument could be made, though, that recognizing that the appeal initiated by her was ineffective, that you should have filed your own notice of appeal in a timely fashion under the notice of appeal court rule, as opposed to the notice of review court rule.
We've considered that, but I'm not aware of any statute or case law that would give technically an appellee an independent right to file a second notice of appeal in the same matter.
Kate?
Sure you could. You could file your own notice of appeal. There's no prohibition on that.
The statute doesn't provide for that, and so that's...
But if you're aggrieved, if you're aggrieved by the decision, you can appeal it. You have a right to appeal within the time frame, as any other party does.
But our court rule seems to imply that once an appeal is initiated, your only option is to file a notice of review.
Yes, thank you, Judge. That's what I was about to say. The minute that you are served with a notice of appeal, the statute is clear that the appellee's only option at that point is to proceed on a notice of review. Unlike other states that have been cited by the appellant, our statute does not provide for an option for an appellee in that instance. For example, if you review the Georgia statute, you'll see that statute expressly says that an appellee in that circumstance has a right to elect its own notice of appeal or a notice of review. Our statutes don't provide for that.
So does it depend? Let's say, you know, if we agree that the dismissal of the notice of appeal doesn't preclude a notice of review from being considered. Does it depend on what the issue is and what the notice of review is requesting? For example, you know, say the notice of review, and this is kind of an unusual one that we have here in front of us. We've never seen anything quite like this. So you were the prevailing party, unsatisfied with the manner in which the court ruled in your favor. You know, we have questions about that if we get to that point, but often we'll have a notice of review that relates to, you know, maybe it's an intermediate order that came along the way that relates to the final order that can be considered on appeal. So now we don't have an existing appeal on a final order that would fit under our jurisdictional requisites for an appeal. Are you following what I'm saying? So now we have this freestanding notice of review And whether or not that's the case, or whether what you're asking us to do, you know, would fall under our jurisdictional requirements of what you have to have, a final order or one of these other circumstances that allow review. What do we do in those?
Is this one of those? Hypothetical. I think in this case, we don't have to answer that because that's not the facts that we have before us. We do have a final order that both sides tried to appeal from, and one did not, and we would argue the other one did successfully appeal from that order. And I think the court would have the jurisdiction to independently review that.
There's another way, which you wouldn't like, that we could not introduce, that we could not get to that question. It's one that Justice Devaney just alluded to. We have held in a number of cases, and I think it's a basic tenet of appellate review, you have to have an adverse decision in order to appeal. Parties usually can't appeal when they win. And your client won. So let's say we sort out all of this notice of review business, and what are we left with?
So I don't know that I agree we prevailed entirely. We filed a petition before the trial court to essentially reform and modify the trust. The appellants filed a counterpetition opposing that and then also seeking other relief. At the end of the day, the court denied both petitions, which we both have the right to appeal from. But the narrow issue on our appeal is that when the court denied their petition, there was a ruling on the construction of the trust that's going to have long-lasting impacts. And so the statute that allows us to appeal says expressly that we have the right to appeal something that may be adverse to us. And that's the argument we're making. The way that this construction could have impacts on this supervision down the road may have an adverse effect on us and our position, which is why we think this issue is important.
So, I don't know if there aren't other questions on the notice of review question, if we get to that, so if we're going to entertain your appeal. So the way you put it is this the court's determination or its interpretation of this trust provision may have some adverse impact on you down the road. Is this ripe? So you don't agree with the court's interpretation of a trust provision. We don't have a scenario where the court has applied that or in a way that you think is erroneous. So, you know, and is it a situation? And so if it goes back to the court and you make your arguments to the court, you got it wrong, the court, circuit court could, reconsider its interpretation. It's just kind of an odd scenario we have here. So you're asking us to declare something that a circuit court did to be dicta. Well, you know, of course, none of that would matter if you came to this court. You know, we would interpret something de novo. It doesn't have any final effect anyway. And it just seems to be kind of an odd scenario and a request. And is it ripe right now?
I would argue it is because the court set out this reasoning that effectively the family trustee doesn't have authority to weigh on distributions, which has been contrary to the position that this trust has taken since it's been sitused in South Dakota, and was contrary to the position of both counsel walking into the courtroom that day. That wasn't an issue pending before the court. The parties didn't have adequate notice that the court was going to go in this direction. We didn't have the opportunity to brief it or make arguments. It was just made in this memorandum decision that is now fully incorporated into a binding order that, if we don't have it addressed on appeal, is a final and binding order that's arguably res judicata.
So what's our relief? Or what relief are you... you hit a home run. What is it? We vacate this. We decide res judicata on our own. We remand for that. What do we do?
Our initial request before the court was to just simply declare that the circuit court's interpretation of Article 1 is non-binding dicta. And then when we go back before the trial court on other trust administrative matters, there isn't a party, whether it be opposing party.
You want us to declare that it's non-binding dicta?
Yes.
Well, we don't really give declaratory relief. We reverse things. We affirm things. We vacate things. We don't really say, here's the rights of the parties. That's kind of a trial court remedy.
I can accept that. So then the alternative, we have asked for the court to remand this back to the trial court to direct it to set up whether it's further hearing or further ruling, essentially give the opportunity for the parties to be heard on that very issue that she ruled on in her memorandum opinion.
That confuses me. You want us to reverse, you want us to say the trial judge should have ruled on the rule, should have said Rule 60B was not in play because it was an untimely motion.
Yes. So I think procedurally what we're asking is for the court to find that the court should have considered the procedural posture under Rule 60, meaning under subsection 3, the argument about misrepresentation and fraud on the court was probably dead on arrival because it wasn't filed within 1 year. And then the subsection 4 void for service of process argument was res judicata. End of story. We didn't need to discuss anything else.
How's that res judicata? Doesn't res judicata require a ruling in one case, a final ruling in one case, and is then binding in another case? This is all the same case. I mean, I understand that's been 13 years. Mm-hmm. How is that res judicata?
It's a language in an order that was never appealed and is now binding on all the parties going forward.
Do you think this is the same proceeding, or is this a different proceeding under the same case number?
It arguably is the same proceeding under the trust file.
So then why couldn't you just go back to the court? And if there comes an occasion where now you have some issue come up and this, you know, prior determination of the court is impacted and you make your arguments to the court and say, you know what, Judge, you got it wrong, we didn't have the opportunity, here's, you know, if it's still the same proceeding. And then make your argument then. And then if the court doesn't disagree, well, now you've got your appeal to us. And we have a final decision on it that is actually applied to a scenario, and we make that determination.
I would just add to that, Your Honor, is that when she was making, when the trial court was analyzing the subsection 4 voidness argument for lack of service of process, she ultimately agreed with Judge Long that service was proper under the virtual representation statute.
Do you need to win under both res judicata and 60B, or is either one enough?
I think appellate made two arguments. One, that the 2013 order issued was void for lack of service of process, and also under the separate subsection that it should be void because there were misrepresentations made to the court.
So you think you need to win on both?
I would argue, I believe so, yes. I think my time is up. Thank you.
Donovan, you may proceed.
May it please the court and the council. Corey Denovan appearing for Ariana Netter individually and as virtual representative of her minor sister, Samantha Netter, who are beneficiaries of the Six Cataracts Trust, which was established by their grandfather, Edward Netter. This is not the first time, and I think I should add some color and context to this particular appeal. This is not the first time Donald Netter has been before this court. 2017 in Netter versus Netter, Donald's wife had subpoenaed the trustee for information about the trust in their divorce proceeding. The subpoena was withdrawn, but Donald pushed the appeal anyway. And the court held that there was nothing left to decide once the subpoena was withdrawn. The court actually wrote, "The court generally will not rule on an issue if a decision will have no practical effect on the legal controversy." We're here on that same pattern. Donald asks the court to review a ruling he says is dicta. It has no bind legal effect on him. And he's on an appeal he told the court didn't exist because the notice of appeal wasn't perfected. He's not asking that the court rule that Judge Mowry got it wrong. She misinterpreted the trust. He's simply saying her interpretation of the trust should be dicta and non-binding on him.
Your this, view, of course, is we don't even get to we need to get to that.
You don't need to get to
we
that.
We don't have, in fact, maybe we don't have jurisdiction to even decide that.
That's exactly right. So let's start there with the first issue of jurisdiction. It seems to me that you have two options, two roads to go down here, and that's what you should be analyzing. The first is a valid notice of review only if you have a properly perfected notice of appeal.
Rule and number two. What dictates that? What says that you can only have a valid notice of review if there's a valid appeal?
Well, I think the statute 26A.22 itself, it talks about being derivative.
It's a court rule. It's not a statute.
No, 1526A.22. But the way it reads, if you will, an appellee may obtain review of a judgment or order entered in the same action which may adversely affect them by filing a notice of review with the clerk of the Supreme Court within 20 days after the service of the notice of appeal. There's two points to that that are really important. First, there's no appellee without a valid notice of appeal. If there's no valid notice of appeal, if no valid notice of appeal exists, the party's not an appellee. They're a party that must seek review on its own under 26A4.
Well, I'm not sure about that argument. I mean, there'd have to be something for at least the interim of the time period that they've got to act, because we can't go back in time after we sort out jurisdiction to determine whether they were really an appellee or not. I mean, for the moment anyway, it seems like they're an appellee, and they've got to make a decision pretty quickly on whether they're going to get review.
Right. If you follow my logic on the valid notice of review only if you have a proper notice of appeal, it encourages the party to look at the situation that they're in. If there's a court order that negatively, or if they're aggrieved, then they should be filing notice of appeal.
What court rule or statute gives them the authorization to file an appeal when there's already an appeal?
It happens all the time. I mean, the one party will file a notice of appeal on the order, file a docketing statement, go through the whole exercise, and the same party will do it at the same time because maybe they waited the entire time, but they are allowed to file, each files their own notice of appeal.
22, the court rule that you just read, says once an appeal is filed, this is how you do it.
A properly perfected notice of appeal. And that's when the timeline starts ticking.
So that's really the fundamental issue is we've got a court rule in 22 that gives a party, appellee, the ability to come in and say, yeah, I'm aggrieved. There's part of this ruling I don't agree with, so I want the court to review that in addition to what's been raised by the appellant. That's a court rule. Constitution says we can't create our own jurisdiction. I'm not aware the legislature's ever given any authority for someone to file a cross appeal. And so if you don't have a properly perfected notice of appeal, you can't have a cross appeal because there's no jurisdiction.
That's correct.
I think you're going to probably agree with that. But
yes.
But are you aware of any legislative authorization to ever grant a party the authority to cross appeal other than what we have in 1526A3, which says here's the grounds to appeal, and here's the types of orders you can appeal from. It doesn't talk about cross appeals,
right.
So you got to go to 22.
Right.
That's the three is a statute. That's a legislative grant of jurisdiction of this court.
Right. So my point being is that on the one hand, you're going to have to battle with whether or not, and it's up to your decision, whether you're going to decide that a notice of review is only effective on a notice of appeal, a valid notice of appeal.
Yeah, there might be a different outcome if the dismissal is entirely voluntary and jurisdiction otherwise existed. So we've got to sort that out, too, don't you think? We've got to sort out whether it was an improvident appeal, everyone was served, properly perfected, or not, because that could impact the rule.
Right, but then there's the catch-all, what they cite in General Motors versus Newcastle. If you've got a notice of review and your appeal is lost, and it is lost and it could not have reasonably known of the defect in the notice of appeal, your notice of review still stands. You're saved.
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I think, didn't we already enter an order dismissing the appeal? That's decided, right?
Right. That's decided.
So all we have left is the cross appeal.
That's correct.
So that rule that you're suggesting is some reasonableness test and notice and construct. What is that again? This, I know it's in your brief. This, if you're reasonably under some misapprehension.
Right. It's General Motors versus Newcastle County. And it says a notice of review filed is not lost if it could not have reasonably been, have no, if the appellant or appellee or the person filing notice of review could not have reasonably have known of the defect in the notice of appeal.
Seems like a tough rule to apply than just simply saying if the first appeal was infirm for whatever reason, there is no notice of review.
Maybe it was a tricky issue of whether or not an appeal could, how it was perfected. Maybe it's a tricky issue of timing, those types of things. There are rare circumstances, a small door that could be open for those individuals to have their notice of review saved. But if you don't have something like this, then you have a situation like this case where a notice of appeal is filed. You have 12 days still ticking. But what do? They just sit on their hands. They wait for the clock to turn over.
No, they have a right to seek a notice of review. That's
and I'm not. But hear me out. But instead of filing their own notice of appeal and properly perfecting it, knowing that they're going to argue that that other notice of appeal is defective, they sit on their hands and they wait for the clock to run out. Once the clock runs out, then they file a notice of review and move to dismiss. It's gamesmanship, and that's what you're going to encourage by having that type of a rule in place. But I think I've covered everything that, because that's not really the meat on the bone that I want to chew on in this particular argument.
I know, but we might want to.
You might want to, okay.
So, but your argument allows gamesmanship in the opposite direction, which means you could file your appeal, then the other party files their notice of review, then you dismiss your appeal, and then their notice of review is gone.
No, actually the opposite. What it encourages both parties to take a look, are we agreed by the order that was entered? And if so, then I want to properly perfect the notice of appeal to preserve my rights in that appeal. That's what it encourages.
Isn't the better, well, I don't know better, but I mean, I don't know that there's any binding authority. I think we're talking about a rule. Wouldn't the more provident rule that applies and doesn't really get into subjective gamesmanship or reasonableness or whatever would be a rule that as the legislature has denominated it, you get a appeal as a matter of right. And if you, because you got to have that legislative authority, and if you properly perfect it, there's jurisdiction and someone can obtain review. If, however, you imperfectly perfect it, or you don't engage the appellate jurisdiction, you haven't really complied with what the legislature says is necessary to get jurisdiction from the get-go.
Correct.
And then the whole thing is a house of cards and everything falls in.
Correct.
That takes gamesmanship and subjectiveness and sitting on your hands and you should be held responsible. It takes that all out of the equation. It's a very clean rule.
Agreed. So the next issue under the notice of review that they're filing and they're relying on for their argument here is that 26A 22 permits review only of an order which may adversely affect the appellee. Here's the problem. Donald's entire position on the merits is that Judge Mowry's ruling is non-binding dicta. If the ruling is non-binding dicta, it has no legal effect on him. If it has no legal effect on him, it does not adversely affect him, and the notice of review falls on the face of the statute. If, on the other hand, the ruling does adversely affect him, then it has legal effect. And if it has legal effect, it's not dicta. He loses on the merits of the very issue he brought to the court. He can't have it both ways. Whichever branch he takes, he loses. Now, as you pointed out earlier, Donald prevailed below. Judge Mowry denied Ariana's counterpetition every respect. Donald has never argued, not in his opening brief, not in his reply, that Judge Mowry construed the trust incorrectly and therefore he's adversely affected. He does not ask this court that he may participate in distribution decisions. He asks only that the ruling be declared non-binding. Under a notice of review under 26A.22, the court's jurisdiction doesn't extend that far, is my argument. It's an advisory opinion. Next, and ground three is I think we've already covered this, so I don't want to belabor it, is the South Dakota's other jurisdictional statute, 26A3 and 26A7. Those enumerate what may be appealed: judgments, final orders affecting a substantial right, A ruling on whether a sentence in a memorandum opinion is dicta fits none of these. It's not a judgment. It's not an order. It's a characterization of the reasoning that the court used. Let me turn to part two, whether the finding Donald has no power over trust distribution was necessary to dispose of the claims of fraud on the court. Donald's first premise is the trial court must resolve procedural issues, res judicata, before reaching the merits of our petition. There's no such rule, and he cites none that say so. There are courts of limited jurisdiction, this appellate court, federal courts, that are constitutionally confined to cases and controversies properly presented. It's prudent there to clear procedural hurdles because a court without power to hear the case has no business opining on it. Contrast that with courts of general jurisdiction. They're different. A circuit court's decision carries no precedential weight beyond the law of that case. Judicial economy to manage its own docket, where there's a thorny procedural issue and a straightforward merits question, both sit before it. The court can take either road, the simpler road. Donald's own authority proves this point. Look at Carson versus Kaiser
Foundation. That's an interesting argument. Actually, I was going to ask Mr. Sett about it. So let's say this appeal is dismissed, and something comes up down the road, and it implicates a portion of Judge Mowrey's decision. There's a pretty good argument. I don't want to get too far afield, but I suppose there would at least be an argument there for preclusion, which generally requires a final judgment. There's a pretty good argument that remains on that score interlocutory because there was an effort to directly appeal, but a reviewing court wouldn't permit it. So it's not as if they let it go final without doing anything. Would you agree that the court would that an order like that could remain, or at least there's an argument that it remains interlocutory and non-final out into time?
Boy, that's a heavy and dense question to argue right off the top of head, but I think there is an argument for that leaves the issue open. Just to give you, let me just point out the fact that his decision that he doesn't have decision-making authority over distributions of the trust doesn't really matter. When he was appointed investment advisor, he moved all of the assets out of the trust and into an LLC that he controls as manager. If he doesn't want a distribution to be made, he doesn't give any money to the trustee. It's illusory. Donald, and that's what we were arguing to the trial court, you got to understand how these things fit together. Donald virtually controls, not virtually, he does control everything. And distributions don't occur unless he releases money up to the trust to pay for them. Let me get back to my argument that I was going to. In Carson versus Kaiser Foundation, the court observed that there can be alternative holdings, procedural and substantive. And those are, as I quote, a welcome blessing for trial courts because it's a case where they say that general courts, general jurisdiction, trial courts, there's a value of deciding both issues. It's not a case about a duty to decide one versus the other, one first, procedural over a substantive. It's to decide both of them. And the three South Dakota cases that Donald cites, Rushenberg, Brummer, and Mellis, those are this court describing its own appellate practice in one sentence. None of them announce a rule binding on circuit courts that you have to decide procedural issues first. They don't cite a statute or a case that would bind a court to do that. There's a lot more I'd like to say, but my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Downing. Ms. Dorsett, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Starting first with the notice of review and the jurisdictional question, we submit to the court that each statute is in its own place establishing jurisdiction. Under subsection 4, under 1526A4, an appellant files a notice of appeal, and that statute sets out how that party satisfies the requirements in order to satisfy the jurisdictional question. After that notice of appeal is served on the appellee has separate rights under completely separate and independent statute to establish its appellate right.
So I think there's a problem with that argument. if you accept the idea that I think is a solid one, that only the legislature can authorize appellate jurisdiction, the 22 reference is not to a statute. That is a court rule. That is not a statute. And I know it's confusing because it looks like a statute. Mm-hmm. There's a court rule. So then there's the question, I mean, as the chief said, can we create our own jurisdiction? Doesn't seem like that seems right, and that becomes a problem with that argument.
I think the rule, I think, as interpreted on its face, does make that argument for us. And to respond to appellant's argument on gamesmanship, Justice Myron beat me to it, because if we interpret this rule differently, meaning that if there's a race to the courthouse and the appellant gets his notice of appeal filed first, and the only other option under that rule is for the appellee to pursue its notice of review, then gamesmanship could apply, where we intentionally file a defective notice of appeal, let the time run out, then move to dismiss it because we recognize our own mistake, and now we have an appellee who has no independent right to review.
Are you saying that,
if I understand your argument correctly, so 1526A3 is where the legislature said these are the type of orders that are directly appealable as a matter of right in South Dakota.
Yes.
And then we enacted two court rules, which are those two other ones that the party keep citing as statutes, but they're actually court rules. And in the court rules, we said, if you're filing an appeal, here's how you do it. And once an appeal is filed, this is what you have to do. You have to file a notice of review. But those are rules that we made about how you invoke the jurisdiction.
Right.
And if I understand your argument correctly, is when you read those two, you're saying, once an appeal is initiated, our only method of doing this is filing a notice of review.
That's how I interpret it, Your Honor. Yes.
Where does that come from, though? I mean, I don't understand how you reach that position. What's the authority for that?
It's the plain reading of the rule, in my opinion.
Which
because,
rule?
22.
What about Rule 26A-46 that specifically talks about joint appeals?
I read that statute, and the way I interpret that statute is when you have two parties whose interests are aligned and could be technically joined on the same side of a matter. I don't read that statute to allow otherwise opposing
parties. It doesn't
say
aligned. It says interests are such as to make joinder practical, which I think is different, isn't it? I mean, so wouldn't that apply to a case where both parties file an independent notice of appeal? And so their interests are such that joinder is practical.
I can see that argument. Okay. In my experience, joinder has been with parties who at least share similar interests and can stay on the same side of the caption.
I kind of want to pick a nit, but the 22 rule says an appellee, as we know, may obtain review. It doesn't say an appellee may only obtain review by following this procedure. Interpretations could perhaps vary, but mm-hmm. it doesn't contain that exclusive language. I suppose we could interpret it the way you suggest, and that's not a bad argument you've got. It doesn't say that, though.
Right. But the statute, the rule also doesn't say that the ability of the appellee to proceed on his or her appeal is dependent or conditioned upon the legal effect of the notice of appeal.
Let's not say that.
And I just want to touch briefly on this dicta argument. And to briefly respond, I mean, this, as it currently stands, is a final court order. And I certainly recognize that this judge would have the authority to reconsider that language, maybe issue an amended order down the road. But as it currently stands, this is a binding court order that other jurisdictions, other parties, and other matters could rely on to take a position in a different matter.
When you say binding to other jurisdictions?
Well,
a circuit court order?
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Appellant brought up the fact that there's pending matters in Connecticut concerning these same parties, different matter related to divorce and things collateral to the trust, I think the ultimate concern here could be that a different judge could point to the language in that order and use it at least as persuasive authority in a different matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court will be in recess.